Hello, and welcome to State of the Revolution. The political revolution sweeping the country today is led from the grassroots up, powered by people from across the political spectrum, organized by our common values, goals, and circumstances. Today, the revolution is a network of alliances, still tenuous, exchanging ideas, raising questions, challenging the corrupt establishment of the classical political spectrum. We are a people waking up, as if from long slumber, growing in number, building the social power to change the world. That means changing our culture, changing the stories we tell ourselves, each other, and our children about how the world works, why it works that way, and how to live well in the world with other people. Today on State of the Revolution, we'll be talking about the story of marijuana, what our culture insists we must believe, what experience and science demonstrate are true, and the revolutionary news story our cannabis community allies have distilled into Proposition 1 appearing on Michigan ballots this November. I'm your host, Leon O'Sharon. With me today are Jillian Dawson, chair of the Michigan Democratic Party Cannabis Caucus, and Jamie Lowell, Michigan Legalized board member and one of the authors of Proposition 1. My co-host is Dr. Shauna McNally, a local activist in Washtenaw County, where she recently ran for State House in the Michigan 55th District. As I said, our culture tells us stories about marijuana, most of which just aren't factual. To set the stage, I'd like to turn it over to Jillian and ask you to give us some historical background. How did cannabis laws come to be the way they are today, and why?
Okay, so that's a very big, broad question. Sure. So I'll try to get it down to a few succinct points to get us to where we are right now. So we could first talk about just it was legal. There was a point in time where it was available for people to grow hemp. George Washington was a hemp grower. It became demonized around the same time of like prohibition. It became a way for people to criminalize other people and control other people. So in like the 20s and 30s, they were starting to say, or government was starting to say that, different corporations were starting to say that Black people and Mexican people were becoming more dangerous when they were using cannabis. They started to call it marijuana because it's a Spanish word for cannabis, and it sounded more scary. So they started to put these terms on it. They started to turn it into this reefer madness, which we later did see closer to the 70s. And then Nixon started to roll out his war on drugs. So then that really took us into a place where people are getting put into prison for cannabis and really getting criminalized for these things. Their houses are getting taken away, children. And it's also really, there's a lot of discrepancy in how they enforce those laws too. So there's a lot of problems with the war on drugs and how that all came about in the 70s. And then we started to have a period of people starting to like explore with this, and that kind of took us into like 2008, which is when we proposed our medical cannabis law in Michigan. And then the people then came out and decided, I wouldn't say overwhelmingly, but definitely in support of cannabis. So
Legalization, full legalization as opposed to just medical.
In 2008 we were talking about medical. Okay. So I can't really speak on that.
Okay.
Well, it was overwhelmingly. It was by 63% of the vote.
63.
And in every single county it passed by more than 50%, all 83 counties.
The medical marijuana.
The medical act did, yeah. Mm-hmm. Michigan Medical Marijuana Association.
Okay. So how did that develop from there? You've been involved in writing the new legislation, which I assume means that you've had some experience leading up to that as well. So how did that go? I don't think you need to lead quite into that
so much.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, where I usually broadcast, we have to speak right into the mic because they're much nicer. I'm not used to that.
Yeah. No, I think we are. I think we've got good levels.
And then also, just before I get started real quick, I want to point out I have a therapy dog with me, Zita, so if anybody sees her running around here, that explains that. She makes us all a little bit happier when she's around. So. I did get involved shortly after passage of 2008, and I was in support before, but not much of an activist. I would show up at Hash Bash, and I even passed out some pamphlets for normal before then, but I really got involved when I saw that there was going to be some opportunity. We didn't really know what we were getting into after the passage of the act, but naively thought that this represents, some movement in Michigan. We had seen some things really grow in Colorado and California and other states by then, and assumed, you know, we're kind of next in line, kind of not thinking about the opposing forces that would soon make their presence known. But, you know, it was a time in which there were other things not working out so well, and it was viewed as a much-needed opportunity for a lot of us. So I got involved at that point.
An opportunity for what? Because, I just want to clarify, because I know that a lot of the criticism that we're seeing, like just recently, some of the law enforcement people that came out to criticize said, well, one of the things is that people are just in it for the money.
Right.
You know, so when you say opportunity, what's the opportunity?
Well, the opportunity is a win-win scenario, and we presented it as such at our city in Ypsilanti, and it is to be able to carry out the spirit and intent of the act, which is to help people. For those who choose to use cannabis and can benefit from it, to be able to make that an easier situation in which more information is available and more variety of products are available, and to help carry out functionally the intent of the act, while also offering economic development opportunities to the locations that would like to embrace it. I mean, we could see what was happening in other states a little bit, and
sure.
Michigan was a little bit different in its law. It had a licensing program along with an affirmative defense. Mm-hmm. And to put that into perspective, everything that we've seen grown out of California started with an affirmative defense. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting a little bit off, but yeah. some of this history kind of like fits in a little bit.
Sure.
So the idea of the affirmative defense is there's certain elements that must be demonstrated in order to assert your defense and have your case dismissed. That's how it's designed in the law.
So when you mean you assert your defense against being prosecuted for...
You were arrested at that point.
Right.
And in California that did happen. Mm-hmm. But people then were able to utilize the law, demonstrate the elements that they are required to, and have their case dismissed. And after doing that so many times, the police realized this isn't worth the time and the resources to continue this.
Let me just clarify. So in California, you're saying there was an affirmative defense law that was passed first? That
was in the mid-90s, and that's what everything was built off of.
Okay.
We've seen, you know, some of the real growth and the original innovations of a lot of the things that are, you know, are commonly still used now, and that all came out of that affirmative defense.
So what, tell me about that affirmative defense being that it's necessary for medical reasons, or there's some other, what is the affirmative
defense? Sure, it's like there was a doctor who developed a relationship with, gave your personal information to, medical history to. That person evaluated it, perhaps did an examination, and then determined that you could possibly benefit from cannabis. In Michigan, it goes on to require that there's an adequate supply and that the person benefits. Of course, the patient is the one who can make that determination.
Okay.
And so if allowed to be carried out as intended, those things would have resulted in some similar loosening of policies concerning cannabis and more growth sooner here in Michigan. But we were about the 12th state in, and by the time it got going here, the word had gotten out, and it appeared as though feds and other sources have gotten to the municipal leagues, the township associations and things like that, and have demonstrated how you keep this activity down and how you keep it on the criminal side and how you interpret it more restrictively so it can't be carried out to its full intent. You know, it's never been. We're 10 years in, and it's never been properly implemented, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
People talk about how poorly it's written and how vague it is and all this kind of stuff. I disagree with that. It's actually just really broad and liberal. A lot of people don't want to embrace the fact that it allows for a lot of activity without police interaction, but that was never respected. And, of course, bringing in an attorney general such as Bill Schuette within a couple of years of its passage completely ruined any chance we may have had of any kind of, like, sensible implementation. But we decided, not knowing that we were going to get all this opposition at the time, that it was a good idea to take advantage of this in the midst of there not being as many opportunities anymore. I was personally in real estate. I was an appraiser. I had some investment properties. I worked with brokers and other people, and we had a building in Ypsilanti, and people who needed something to do, and this law passed, and that's how we got started, and we put that together. And I really learned, at that point I was in support of cannabis, but I learned a lot more about it. And we began helping people, and the system began functioning. We became a central location for those caregivers who had more medicine than what they need for their immediate patients and could bring it to us, and we can make it available to those who need it. And that's why we had a lot of information, a lot of diversity of products in one location. Mm-hmm. And it was designed on that. Now, there are other models that came in, other people did things differently, in which it was around maybe making more of the money. And those elements, of course, you know, exist. Mm-hmm. But our philosophy was to kind of have that balance.
So when you talk about pushback that you received with the medical law, especially you mentioned Bill Schuette, have some of those similar forces been pushing back against? I know that, for instance, like Prop 1 didn't make it on to the ballot a few years ago,
sure,
to question the signatures. So what has been your experience getting to this point of this proposal?
Right. Okay. So, you know, and I did take some time getting into some minutia of the other stuff here. But so essentially I got started after 2008. We have a favorable city there in Ypsilanti,
yes,
and we're able
do.
To work with them very comfortably, much differently than some other places. I did use that experience to go on and speak with many localities around the state and try to get people to embrace this activity. And in some cases, there are certain levels of accomplishment, and then there could be a change of even a chief of police or a sheriff or a prosecutor. And then anything that was kind of tolerated before, you know, didn't necessarily continue that way. And mm-hmm. and what we were lacking mainly was direction from the state. Mm-hmm. So we began the process of trying to legislatively get some more definition of the commercial side of this and began that process. Now, along the way, we realize that, I mean, this is from my perspective, other people have wanted legalization all along.
Mm-hmm.
I grew into wanting legalization out of need, mm-hmm. Mainly on behalf to make it easier for patients to get to the medicine that they've been being denied, mm-hmm. Based on, you know, just a few decision makers, and like Schuette, for example, and not necessarily what the masses are okay with. And so... There was an attempt at a full repeal, a constitutional amendment in 2012 called Repeal Today.
Mm-hmm.
The discussion started off being Strengthening the Medical Marijuana Act. And we met at a place called Cannabis Council in Detroit, mm-hmm. and Jefferson's Matt Abel and Thomas Levine are the partners, and they are two well-known attorneys in the marijuana field, and they're also activists in their own right. And they sit on the board with me, and I legalize them. Matt Abel's the executive director of Michigan Normal. That was not successful. We learned a lot mm-hmm. from that, and we began focusing back in on the legislative side of things, because the legislators were now, you know, taking up the idea of a medical marijuana commercial system. We worked with people to try to get that to happen and try to emulate the functioning system that was already playing out around the state. Well, we'd kind of started in Ypsilanti.
Mm-hmm.
That had gone over to Ann Arbor, in which it wasn't as braced as well. Like, we got a licensing system in Ypsilanti. In Ann Arbor, they got more of a tolerance based on mm-hmm. when state recognition would be available. But it still worked. It mm-hmm. functioned very similarly. And this happened, you know, in some other places around. But the elements of big business now seeing, well, you know, there's probably some tolerance for this, or the people are loosening up for this. We can feel more comfortable maybe with more investment and getting involved. But some of those perspectives were based on controlling the market, mm-hmm. you know, with a small group of people, and not necessarily continuing this idea of having this be a new opportunity and a new emerging thing for many people,
yeah.
Particularly for the people who have been really oppressed, you know, through the enforcement, you know, over cannabis, our black and brown citizens, 3-4-1, you know, according to a study by the ACLU, and but that was helpful in a way to kind of get things moving in reality of that. Let's really look at legalizing, but it was certainly not the way that we would want to see this market control. And
so just to clarify, so what you're saying is that once the activist cannabis community had made the push and grew the awareness and built the power to actually have the medical marijuana laws passed, and it started to become more normalized across the state, and then you had big business looking at that and saying, hey, we could actually make a lot of money here.
Yeah, as we're starting to try to you know, kind of codify the system that we're seeing, you know, play out and work.
Right.
the big business interests are saying, yeah, we can do something here, and, you know,
right,
kind of take more control of it. So that was the process that we then ensued in the legislature.
I think one of the key points about Proposition 1, and maybe Jillian, you could speak to this, is what really changes for people who aren't in the business, people who are medical marijuana users currently, or people who want to use recreationally. How does this new legislation, should it pass this November, which I certainly hope it does, how does that change what your everyday citizens experience?
Okay, yeah. So for the consumer, for anyone over the age of 21, you'll now be able to consume cannabis, not publicly or in a place where the person who owns the property doesn't want you to do that, but in your own place you could do that. You can also grow up to 12 plants and store up to 10 ounces. Is it 10 pounds? It's 10 ounces of dry flower, and then up to some of that 10 ounces can be concentrate, I think up to 14 grams. And then the thing that will probably change the most is you'll be able to purchase these things from dispensaries, but there will be an extra excise tax on top of the 6% sales tax that we already pay in Michigan. It'll be 10%.
Okay.
So total of 16% tax on that.
Are there any restrictions about transporting this or anything like that? Are there special requirements about how you what kind of a container you have to have, or, you know, if you're picking it up at the dispensary and going home, or if you're going out to, you know, camp at a public, a public park or something like that?
Yeah. Jamie, you helped in writing the law, right? I might defer this
one. No, there's nothing like that in there.
Okay.
And that does not exist for patients and caregivers either. That was a law that was passed by the legislature, but it was then deemed not applicable to patients and caregivers because it did not override the Michigan Medical Marijuana Act.
Okay.
So that's where that comes from. So
is there any allowance? A 16% sales tax, I mean, it's high, but if we're talking about this being an extension of medical marijuana, is there any exemption for patients who are prescribed this?
Actually, yeah. Okay. If you're a patient buying your medicine from your caregiver, there is no tax.
There's 3% current excise tax for patients, but it's written into the MMFLA that if legalization comes into play, then the excise tax will go away then for the patients. And the number is relatively low comparatively. Colorado started off with a combined 35% tax, and that turned out to be too high. It didn't entice people out of the black market into the new commercial market as readily as they had hoped. So it had to be reassessed. So I just wanted, if it's okay, to kind of hit the history back up again.
Yeah.
I was almost getting to the interesting part.
Oh,
but when we realized that we really have these forces coming in, and this whole thing could just turn into a small group of people controlling everything, so we got serious about needing to go to the people and get something on a statewide poll and really define things on our own terms before it was done for us. And that's when MI Legalized was born in early 2015.
So that speaks to one of the key parts of Prop 1 is the micro business part. That's really that's really a key part of how MI Legalize decided to combat the big business aspect of this, as I understand it.
Well, yeah, that came in the second round. MI Legalize did a run first in which we were unsuccessful. We did collect, you know, signatures equaling about 5% of the electorate, and we did submit them, and we did believe that we covered all applicable requirements in order to do that, but we had disputes as we had certain policies and things that were in place that were argued eliminated us. We ended up still believing we were unconstitutionally disallowed from participating in the democratic process, but nonetheless we didn't make it. At the time when we had to decide whether or not to continue this, it became obvious that there was support in other groups. Some of these factions who wanted more control, for example, knew that there was probably a possibility of doing something legislatively and or through the initiative process again. The legislature, I think, was a little bit more compelled after the experience of the first round of MI legalized to push through what is now the MMFLA, which looks completely different than the plan that we started with, which mm-hmm. reflected what was, you know, working early on.
Sure.
It became this really, in my opinion, you know, overly regulated, restrictive, you know, kind of thing. It's a start for us. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not knocking that, but mm-hmm. We were heading in a much better direction, and it included the caregivers and that kind of stuff. And that's where the micro stuff comes in mm-hmm. a little bit more. So the second time around when we had to or chose to work with a bunch of people, this way we combine resources and only have one proposal to get mm-hmm. behind. And it mm-hmm. makes it a lot more right. probable that we'll be successful yeah. under those circumstances. So right. the second time around, it wasn't nearly as good as, I would say, the language the first time that we tried to do this.
Okay.
But one of the ways to cover the in my opinion, the unceremonious, you know, disregard for the caregivers and from the medical system was to have these micro opportunities. And there's two things. One's yeah. a micro garden, mm-hmm. which is a 100-plant garden of caregivers, if they're growing for themselves and they have five patients, can get up to 72 plants.
Mm-hmm.
So to scale up from 72 to 100 should be a lot easier, in our opinion, than mm-hmm. to go up to 500 or mm-hmm. to the 1,500 or 1,000.
Sure.
And so, and that is available there. The micro business is the other mm-hmm. possibility, and that is a self-contained unit, similar to like a micro brewery, which you grow, process, and retail in the same mm-hmm. building. The micro garden will sell into the wholesale market, to mm-hmm. dispensaries or to processors,
mm-hmm.
But the micro business will not buy from or sell to the wholesale market. It all remains under one roof. And that is those are options. Now, the other part of that, we had to write the Prop 1 to be congruent with the MMFLA, which is another departure from the original MI legalized language. And the same five licenses that are available through MMFLA are then, by almost, you know, set of circumstances, have to be available through Prop 1.
So let me ask specifically about that, because one of the big issues for big business has been that the what they've been able to do in the legislature is have these very, very high cost of entry. So, for example, you know, they do it a little bit with liquor stores. If you want to have a liquor store, you need your application fee is something like $50,000. But for cannabis dispensaries, it's $300,000, which is like six times as much.
Yeah, well, there's a bit of a discrepancy there because it's not necessarily a fee. It's just a capitalization requirement. You just have to show that
there are enough ridiculous fees that we could complain about them.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, the annual fee for a dispensary that they've estimated for this year is going to be close to $60,000 after your $12,000 fee and then your $48,000 regulatory assessment fee every year.
So the capitalization, you're right, I'm sorry, that's the $300,000 is the capitalization requirement,
yeah.
whereas I think for the liquor store it's $50,000. I said
yeah.
that wrong, right?
No, so, you said it right, you just didn't say it.
Yeah, it's a capitalization requirement.
Right.
So to me, that looks like an outright attempt by big business to keep out smaller folks that don't have that kind of capital. Is there any? Have you heard any justification for anybody why it should be that high?
From where I'm sitting, I haven't heard any.
You know, the department has said they've looked at other states to see what they've done and mm-hmm. gleaned a little bit from that, which mm-hmm. is kind of a poor excuse because it still doesn't explain mm-hmm. what the numbers come from. And they've also said that it helps them to trust that those entering in the business that have that kind of capitalization that's not included in their immediate investment makes mm-hmm. them feel more comfortable for survivability during the times when things are getting off the ground or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some like discussion about it. I don't think anybody's been satisfied with exactly the formula used to determine this stuff. And the end result is it does keep a lot of people out of being able to participate.
Right.
And I just wanted to say from before, the ability to get one of the new licenses under Prop 1, that's the counterpart to MMFLA, is you must have that MMFLA
yeah.
license first for up to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
To get what under Prop 1, you have to have the license for 2 years?
To get your recreational license under Prop 1, you'd have to be licensed under the Michigan Medical Marijuana Facilities and Licensing Act for 2 years.
So basically,
no, you don't have to be licensed for 2 years, for up to a 2 year period. People who have their MMFLA license will be first in line to get that relative legalization license.
Okay. So it would open up after that point?
For other people, right?
Okay.
And the difference is those micro opportunities.
Right.
Somebody doesn't
right.
have to have the MMFLA requirement first
okay.
for those.
Right.
For the micro opportunities.
You can just get right
okay.
in.
Okay. And is there a capitalization requirement for the micro opportunities?
Well, a lot of things are yet to be decided. This leaves a lot up to locals, and it also leaves a lot up to a regulator. This will be a State Department that oversees things as there is right now with medical marijuana. Mm-hmm. But a huge difference is we kind of like define the parameters mm-hmm. and say if A, B, and C, then rubber stamp, you know,
okay.
and not have these weird subjective obstructions that are taking place now with the review board for medical marijuana.
Right. And when you have a system like that where it's so subjective, what happens is that you have some people that have more influence than others, and it's not going to be the small folks that are, that don't have that kind of capitalization who are going to have the influence. It's going to be people that can donate a lot to political campaigns and influence the system in general. So that's a good. That's important that's written in there so that we have more equity between people of different levels of influence with the government. We don't want we want people to be treated fairly.
One criticism I've heard of the entire thing is that. You know, I coming back and seeing these numbers, it actually makes a lot of sense. But the communities, like as we said, black and brown communities who have been policed, who have been jailed, who have been oppressed by these particular laws, now we are making it legal. That's great. It's a big step. But keeping the people who have traditionally been oppressed out of these business opportunities. And yeah, I mean, I don't know how you're going to. Most people don't have $300,000 sitting around.
I mean, to put it in perspective, the median income in Michigan is $48,000. That's
right.
The same as the regulatory assessment for
right.
the year.
Right.
So that's what you're saying is definitely true.
Yeah.
Now, as I understand, is there not a law in Michigan that says that regulatory assessment has to be based on what it actually costs the department to make that assessment, and it can't be more than that?
Yeah, they justify it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
yeah.
Do they give you a line by line accounting? I mean, you know, if I'm a business owner and one of my departments is saying, hey, it's going to cost us this much to do this, I want a line by line to say why is it going to cost that much? Because that sounds like a lot of money to do an assessment every year when you've already done one the last year, for example.
Yeah.
You know, is there? Any information on that, or how much information we're going to get about how they decide that it's $48,000?
Well, they determine a formula based on how many people are applying versus what they need, you know, this type of thing, and that's there, I guess, and that could be applied against the reality of who submitted their application and that type of thing. But
well,
I'm not sure if we'll see that kind of detailed accounting on this
right.
or not.
Okay,
I would doubt it.
Well, we could push the legislature to make a law that says that they have to.
The locals can charge up to $5,000, and they're, you know, on the smaller level, supposed to justify that too. There's
mm-hmm.
some little townships that aren't going to spend that much every year, but they're going to collect their maximum amount, and
mm-hmm.
probably nobody's going to make a complaint about it. So, I mean, it's just kind of the way it goes down a little bit. If it gets really egregious, though, and there's some really serious questions, there'll be some avenues for that challenge. I just want to add, you know, all of these issues that are possible, or the different ways things could be interpreted and then ultimately, you know, subsequently amended, has a lot to
right.
do with who we surround this new law with
mm-hmm.
in leadership and legislature mm-hmm. and the governor's office mm-hmm. and the attorney general's office.
Sure.
And
sure.
We can make this go a whole different direction than it has up to this point.
Right.
And I'm kind of looking forward to that. Certainly looking forward to the opportunity.
So speaking of that, you know, what are you hearing from people currently in the legislature or in the mechanisms of government in the various departments and so on about what are they saying about this in private that maybe we're not hearing publicly?
Okay. Do you have anything you want to
throw out there? Anyone want to feel that
right.
one?
I didn't quite catch it. I have to.
Oh no! So I've like for example, I asked around some people that I know who are in the legislature
okay.
to give me some insight on why $300,000, for example.
Okay.
And and you know, they basically said, look, nobody has a really good reason for it. It's because they can get away with doing it. And yes, the people that are pushing it are people that are well known to be good friends with folks who are actively trying to do big business stuff with it.
It thins out the herd and keeps things more controlled.
Right.
So it's a slower rollout.
So it's definitely, you know, that part of it is definitely happening because there are people and there are people with a lot of money who would prefer to keep as many people out as possible and leave more of it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I mean I can hear that, you know, in sort of like a vague way from the from my contacts in the legislature.
Yeah, some of those forces are what I referred to earlier.
Right,
the big money people who would like to control most of the market.
Right. So I'm wondering what else are you hearing? Because you're sitting in conversation with these with people in the regulatory system, in the legislature. You're talking with people that are, you know, that are in the administration about how this will be rolled out and all of that kind of stuff. What are you hearing from them? How they think about this and what their motivations are and how they see this going forward that maybe we're not hearing, in public. What's happening in the negotiation room that we might not be hearing?
I'm not privy to everything that happens in the negotiation room. I can see when influences kind of come into the department sometimes and they pull out a bulletin and mm-hmm. it may not make that much sense, you know, mm-hmm. based on having some real mm-hmm. understanding of the nature of cannabis mm-hmm. or how things are unfolding mm-hmm. and things like that. But I think they're having a little bit of a scenario where they don't really exactly know everything themselves, and they're taking information in from many different sides and mm-hmm. just trying to determine the best way to go. I will say they've made some mistakes, but they also have been open to correcting them mm-hmm. when it's come down to it. And there's like a functional thing unfolding here, but it's very like frustrating, and it kind of goes back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of it. That's how I see it. I'm not necessarily sure there's this huge weird strategy to. Mm-hmm. Accommodate anybody in particular. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the big players was turned down recently. I think they're on appeal and everything mm-hmm. and now, but, one of the groups behind, you know, really getting some mm-hmm. things moving here were turned down on their application for a technicality recently. So there's not like that type of, you know, blatant, you know, favoritism,
right.
but I think they're trying to figure it out to some degree, and they're having a hard time because it's brand new for them.
That's actually a really good point that I want to emphasize, something that happens in a lot of different places, which is there's a difference between outright corruption and systemic corruption. And the mm-hmm. systemic corruption is when you put into law that you have to have this huge capitalization that excludes a whole lot of people by default. And then outright corruption would be when, you know, they just rubber stamp the applications of the people that are, that are influencing them through campaign donations or other kinds of influence. That's a different kind of corruption. What's interesting to me is that in the U.S. we have a lot less of the latter. We have a lot less of the outright just rubber stamp because I'm being influenced by this person or somebody's being influenced by this person, and a lot more of the systemic corruption mm-hmm. where it just automatically excludes whole swaths of people that aren't on the inside. But you answer that question. Did you have some different insight into that, or?
I mostly have insight on my local level, being mm-hmm. here in Lansing.
Sure.
So I just, having some conversations with some of our local leadership. You mm-hmm. know, it sounds like some of them are less than excited about Lansing mm-hmm. being a weed capital. Mm-hmm. They don't really want that. But it's strange because if we were a car capital or a beer capital, nobody would. Be complaining.
It was beautiful early on to watch Michigan Avenue just come back to life.
Right.
It was urban renewal by definition.
Yeah.
It was awesome, but of course you can't have that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Actually, Weed Maps, they sponsored all of these billboards across our city, which were great. They were just giving facts about, like, you know, what happened out in Colorado after they legalized. And mm-hmm. one of them, it said, "Hi, Lansing," like "Hello, Lansing," but they spelled it H-I-G-H.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of our local leaders took that to mean that they were labeling us High Lansing. And they're like, "We don't want to be known as High Lansing." It's like, okay, I think you're missing the point here. So that's a lot of the stuff that I've been running into. And,
gotcha.
You know, other local leaders just saying, you know, if it passes, I think that's good. And everything else, it's just details. So they're just, they either don't realize the implications that it has on, like, the working people that want to be participating in this, mm-hmm. or they just don't care.
So I want to backtrack a little because we've moved on, but it's still kind of lingering in my head as a question. When we talked about the micro business and caregivers, are you using caregivers to mean physicians who prescribe? Or caregivers of people? My first impression was you meant like people who are taking care of somebody.
Caregiver is basically just a term that they use in the MMFLA and to distinguish somebody who can grow plants for patients. So it's a person who does something within the law. They grow the plants and they cure that, and then they provide it to their patients. Yeah,
they were created in the original MMFLA.
But if you say their patients, that's what I'm wondering about. What does that mean?
A caregiver can have up to 5 patients. They have to meet certain requirements, be 21 and over, and have a felony. There's some caveats to that.
They have to have the qualifying condition to be a patient.
Caregiver.
Oh, you're talking about caregiver.
I think I can clarify. I think I know what your question is. So, to be a medical marijuana patient, you have to get a referral from a doctor that says that you have a qualifying condition, and then you can get a card for that. And then people can also get cards to be caregivers. And a caregiver card, you have to register which patients that has a patient card are registered under your caregiver license, under your caregiver card.
A patient can choose to have a caregiver or not, and oftentimes it's because that patient can't grow for themselves.
So like if somebody's housebound or something and they need somebody
For whatever reason. Some people just don't want to grow. Some people aren't very good at it. Some people don't have the resources in their own house. And, you know.
All right. Right. Yeah. And so, you don't have to be a patient to be a caregiver.
Okay.
Right.
So just to clear that up, because I might have said something that was confusing.
No, I wasn't sure there's different meanings for that word caregiver.
Right, and sure. Especially in the medical world.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. Yep.
And that's why it was chosen.
Okay.
Right. So there are people that are making some objections to this. I'm just wondering if either one of you could maybe steel man their argument. You know what I mean by steel man? So, you know, it's the opposite of a straw man. Mm-hmm. You know, make the best argument that the opposition makes, and then tell us why that's not a good argument. Anybody want to?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't necessarily view the opposition as having these great, compelling arguments that we couldn't vet through and determine, you know, if we have a real concern here or not. Mm-hmm. But they, in real life, they do have the ability to scare people. They talk about the children and people out there driving around.
That was exactly what was in the piece today, like, literally word for words that this we were actually looking for the article before you guys got here. I had read it this morning. It was very, very uninformative, very bland. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what about the kids? What about the children?
Yeah.
And they were going to have an increase in car accidents. And it was like,
and there's no real reason to believe that. In fact, we've been in real practice now in Michigan and around this country for long enough to not see those things ever happen.
Do you know, especially if you're from Washtenaw County, what went on with that horrible rollout of like we're going to have 5 counties where we can randomly test drivers.
Well, that happened.
We see, right, I know, but where is it going? And do you see that coming in opposition? If this passes, where does that go? Are people still trying to push that as legislation statewide? Because it seemed like a huge invasion.
Well, it's a pilot program, so it's on a schedule, and it'll come up for review. And at that time, they decide: do you keep it? Do we expand it statewide? There are serious science issues with it. That hasn't stopped the legislature or the police from utilizing it, but. You know, I can't speak for its future, but it's ridiculously there.
Okay.
I mean, part of the idea is real quickly is to demonstrate on one hand the swab having some kind of a positive result, and a drug recognition expert coming out and saying, oh yeah, this is what I see too. And then they're saying, okay, see, these things work together, so whenever we have this result now, we can just assume that this is the case.
Yeah.
And there's no science ever being created, but there's ability to criminalize people.
Yeah.
Right.
You guys have been doing this a long time, and having been in other activist movements, I know that once you've been doing it a long time, you have sort of a feel for what are the things that you keep running into that don't seem to be that people still have questions about. Do you have top 3 or 5 things that you see people not really getting and that you'd like to get across?
I guess one thing I could touch on is people often ask if this bill is too corporate. Mm-hmm. They saw what happened in Ohio with the way that didn't pass because everybody knew that it was too corporate.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I would just want to say that it's not a perfect bill, but there are definitely opportunities for people to participate. I wouldn't call it too corporate. And at the end of the day, it legalizes something that has criminalized a huge population in our communities, and will ultimately, I think, be better for us to have it pass than for it not to.
Conditions definitely improve, and I would agree. There's a faction of people who really want legalization, but don't believe that we go far enough. But this is the best we are going to do. And those, and then there are other people who think it's too corporate. It was headed in that direction. And if somebody could have really understood, and I was at the drafting table, as we talked about in the beginning here, there were, you know, factions here that didn't mind the market being controlled, you know, by a small group of people. And at that stage of the game, you know, everybody's giving their input, and they're putting up money, and we're all deciding how we're going to do this. Those things are discussed, and we could have gone that way. And if we don't do this now, those same factions, it's very difficult for us to get together and raise a couple $1 million. You know, we did it a couple times, and finally we got something on the ballot. Mm-hmm. There are some people that are in groups it's not difficult for them to do that,
right,
and they can write it any way they want. If we don't do this now, it doesn't get any better from here. We can make it better from here, though.
So, there's actually, I want to ask about those people that are making that criticism that doesn't go far enough in terms of showing up. I mean, I've heard a lot of, in my experience, typically more establishment type Democrats, more so than progressives, but I've heard from some progressive Democrats as well, wondering if the cannabis community is actually going to show up to the polls and vote, because a lot of people still have this idea, well, there's just a bunch of potheads. Are they really going to, you know, make sure to be there on November 6th?
You don't mind. I don't know if people noticed or not, but I think the cannabis community had a lot to do with Dana Nessel's endorsement by the Democratic Party at the endorsement convention. Am I Legalized endorsed Dana before she was the actual selection of the Democratic Party, because we knew that she had to be there, especially after our experiences. And then at the primaries, I'm not saying that the big numbers were made up of cannabis people necessarily, but we got good signs of a lot of people who now feel as though their voices should be heard after seeing how weird things can get if they're not participating. And so all those things combined, I would say, looks good. Whether or not that happens, that's always the question.
Right. Well, I can certainly attest to from the inside of the campaign. I actually ran Dana Nessel's campaign through the April convention, the endorsement convention, and I can tell you for sure that a ton of that was cannabis people showing up to vote, both at the convention and also in terms of doing stuff around the state to get people to the convention.
And we did not want Miles Jr. in there as much as we wanted Dana in there, just for perspective.
Yeah. I can also add that, you know, we didn't even have a cannabis caucus a couple years ago.
That's
so
right.
Cannabis voters are coming out in the Democratic Party. We're getting together and we're trying to get candidates like Dana Nessel elected to these positions.
Right. Actually, I've heard there's some controversy about whether Michigan was the first Democratic Party to have a cannabis caucus or whether it was California.
Well, there's a little bit of discrepancy, but it's not much. I mean, there's a caucus in California called the Brownie Mary Caucus, and they've been around for quite a while, and they are a cannabis caucus. They're just not called the cannabis caucus.
Really
the caveat. And I mean, they win, I think.
First in Michigan, good enough.
Right, exactly.
Okay, cool. I hadn't heard the I'd heard that there was a controversy. I hadn't heard the details of that. But
yeah, there was a conversation.
Yeah.
And I think it's really cool. At the endorsement convention, I sat in the cannabis caucus, and I had a great time. I thought it was really cool that was happening right there.
And I think it's actually cool. I want to actually commend the MDP leadership for endorsing that. I mean, that was a big question when some of the people that were talking about doing it was wondering if they'd actually be able to get the endorsement of the people in power in the Democratic Party. I commend Chairman Dillon and others who supported that. I think that, you know, as much as I criticize the Democratic Party, you know, I want to give credit where credit's due, and that was a really good thing that they did, I think.
Yeah.
So what would be next? Let's say that this passes, and certainly I hope that it does. What's next for the cannabis community?
I'd like to thank expungement and early release for people that are still suffering.
I like that idea. We wanted expungement in this language, mm-hmm. and it was written in for a little while during the process. The problem with it, as opposed to other issues that are severable, meaning after the act passes, it could then be challenged, and if something is really wrong, that section of it can be taken out and we can move on with the rest of it. We used many great professionals during the course of this drafting, including some national people. But in Michigan, we use who is considered, you know, probably the most respected elections attorney, John Pierce from Honigman, mm-hmm. Who had a concern that if we kept it in there, it's one of the issues that can be challenged before passage of the act, and it's not severable. So whether or not we're totally justified by law to at least allow expungement for what we're making legal within the act, that shouldn't be a problem. But with the way that our courts actually are, and the high risk of having to start from scratch if we'd lost it, we decided to keep it out. That said, that's another reason to make sure Dana and Gretchen and company make it into office, because they are already talking about being in support of helping to push a legislative solution to expungement for people.
And not only that, I would say we also have to look at, we have the opportunity this year to flip the Supreme Court, the Michigan Supreme Court, with Sam Bagenstos and Megan Kavanaugh. And I think that's really, really important. We really have to emphasize this. I just want to, you know, everybody that's watching this, Sam Bagenstos, Megan Kavanaugh, you need to know those names, because they don't show up with a D next to their names on the ballot. They're going to be in the nonpartisan section, and the conservative Republicans that are currently incumbents are going to show up as, you know, Supreme Court Justice such and such a name. Mm-hmm. You know, so we have to really get the message out there about the names, so that people remember the names.
I agree.
And you know, so I'll say it again: Sam Bagenstos, Megan Kavanaugh, Supreme Court Justice for Michigan.
Yeah, I've been to many of these Democratic clubs or political groups, people that want to put on a little information about the proposals coming up and some candidates, and I've been able to hear both of them, or representatives mm-hmm. for both of them, many times, and they are most definitely the way to go, and along with all the other changes that we can possibly make this November.
I'd agree. They both spoke at the Cannabis Caucus at the convention recently, and they're both outspoken about cannabis and support of it. So if you're a cannabis voter, they are good people to vote for.
They're on the list of the changes we can make that's attainable for us.
Mm-hmm.
Good. And the two people that are against were appointed a little bit. They haven't been around for a long time. They're not these established justices,
right?
You know, and hopefully, I'm hoping that this common, you know, cycle of whoever happens to be the incumbent just wins. Mm-hmm. Okay, there's enough circumstances here maybe to break that.
Right, right.
That would be nice.
Yeah. That would be very nice.
But there is the nice storm here for that. There's a lot of support for those who they would, you know, be of the same ilk, let's say. And they achieve a lot of the same things we're all showing up to try to get to achieve.
Right.
Yeah.
So I have a question. Well, it's not really a question. It's more of a concept and a statement. That this step, like you just asked about future steps. Early release and expungement, obviously, that's on everyone's mind, that it really should be happening. But speaking from my particular background as a doctor, I see this far more as a human rights issue, and I hope that it can be a first step into ending prohibition overall, which is, you know, as we were saying, things used to just be legal, and then all of the different circumstances of history have led to where we are now. I've seen that from many different sides. I've seen it both from people who need medication, just like we're dealing with marijuana right now. There are people who need other things that now they, you know, mm-hmm. they cannot obtain them due to excessive regulation. And also, I actually lived in Mexico for quite a while during it's still going on, but during the drug war, and seeing the toll that takes on communities, and you know that we in the U.S. it's rarely the people who are at the top of the, you know, the ladder, as we all know. It's, you know, it's the lower level people. It's the people who are consuming substances who are criminalized. And then whole countries have to take on this burden of you know, supplying our demand. And I see this as a huge step to ending at least one of those, you know, major players that's being trafficked into this country. That's where I come at it personally, that that is what people need. People do not need to be experiencing the violence that goes along with our consumption habits.
You're talking about the people in the countries where it's being grown and transported from. there's a bunch of violence that's being exported from us because of the demand.
I mean, and it happens here too within the communities who have been oppressed by this. It's the same sort of situation. It's just on a much larger scale in other countries. I don't know. Do you guys have any opinions on that? On moving this forward, is this being the first step, or is this sort of where everybody's going to be happy with?
No, this is just the first step, but it is pretty significant. It is significant.
A great
one. I mean, my friend Brad Forrester from the Michigan Normal Board says, tell people that if they want to eliminate 9% of total crime, just simply show up and vote for Prop 1 in November. So that's how much time and energy the police are spending on.
Wow.
On these things, and the labs are spending a lot of their time on these simple cannabis possession testing, and there's the warehouses full of rape kits that go untested because the labs don't have enough time because they're worried about this money generator here, and so the industry is with the police now making money off cannabis and is transitioning to more of a familiar above board kind of a system, and they're kicking and screaming. They just showed up yesterday, the day before, with a big, you know, coordinated press conference.
Yeah,
utilize the same information, and they've done this in the other states. It was pretty predictable that it was going to happen here too, and no new information really. And in essence, they're standing shoulder to shoulder with the people who you're saying that keep the problems alive.
Are you all familiar with what has been? I guess I'll just call it the Portugal model of where they have gone in Portugal. Essentially decriminalization of everything. And if you're found with more than a 2-week supply, like, then you would go to rehab and you know, that's that. And deaths have dropped massively. You know, there's been all these sorts of positive side effects, but getting to that conversation, I feel like within this country is going to be.
Right. But this helps to start that,
right.
though.
That's why I like that.
The other thing I want to point about the Portugal model, which is really, really important, because the way that came about in Portugal, I don't know if most people know about this, but basically the government said, we can't come to an agreement, so what we're going to agree on is we're going to have a panel of experts that are going to figure it out, and they're going to come back to us. And and from what I've read, I don't know that much about it, but from what I've read, it sounds like they had a decent process for getting actual experts that were not biased by, you know, from the corporate side or from the law enforcement side, and were just real medical experts and public health experts on how to deal with public health crisis,
a health issue instead of a criminal issue,
right? Mm-hmm. Health issue, and what they came up with, one of the key parts of their program is that, they have rehab and they have rehab and halfway houses and programs to reintegrate people into the society, including helping them get jobs and supporting businesses that are giving jobs to people that are recovering from that. And I think one of the key things that they talk about is that a big part of addiction in general, regardless of what the substance or the activity is, because you can have drug addictions, you can have gambling addictions, you can have all kinds of different addictions. One of the key components of addiction is disconnection from other people, from the community, because humans are social creatures, and when we don't have that social interaction, that creates the conditions under which people get drawn into drug addiction. Mm-hmm. And so those kinds of I think it's important to talk about the sort of the scope of how they've thought about that at a really deep level.
Yeah, I think that, you know, with the next wave after November, that's the only door that could be open. I mean, we're closing the door on criminality.
Mm-hmm.
So the only one could open would be a health-based.
20,000 plus arrests every year that there'd be less of a need for now, hopefully, if everything. There'll be a transition time. Police aren't still going to, like, take this seriously right away. We did not change the criminal code. They're still going to say, hey, it's still illegal, the criminal code. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll have to deal with all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But this will be significantly better, ultimately.
Well, we have to wrap up here. Any last thoughts from folks? Anything... Any ideas that we haven't covered that we need to at least touch on?
One thing that I should say for everybody out there listening, if you're in Michigan and you want to participate with the Cannabis Caucus of the Michigan Democratic Party, you can find us on Facebook. at Michigan Democratic Party, or no, facebook.com/MICanacaucus.
MICanacaucus.
And that's all one word, MICANNA caucus. Cool. And yep, you could also email us at MICanacaucus@gmail.com. And we we definitely need new members. One of our big pushes after this is going to be starting small chapters in, or just starting local chapters, hopefully not small ones. And across the state. So that's what we're looking at, is if there's a group of four people that want to start a local chapter, if they want to start getting cannabis-minded candidates elected in their areas, contact us. We'll help you with everything that we can.
Okay. I just wanted to thank you both for the work that you've been doing. I know you haven't done it alone, and thanks for coming here and talking about it.
I really appreciate it. MI Legalize is going to come out with some lawn signs, as are the larger coalition. And last 3 to 4 weeks or so are going to be a huge push. And just a reminder, there's so many good things that we could be fixing and gerrymandering, making it easier for people to vote, legalizing cannabis, getting good leadership in place that we haven't had for a long time. I really hope that we take advantage of this opportunity and move the needle this November.
Absolutely. And we'll be having some other conversations about the other propositions that you just mentioned about making it easier to vote redistricting, because that's a huge, huge problem. I want to thank you again, Jamie Lowell, a board member at Michigan Legalize and one of the authors of Proposition 1.
I really appreciate it.
And Jillian Dawson, chairwoman of the Michigan Democratic Party Cannabis Caucus.
Thank you so much.
And Shauna McNally. An activist from Washtenaw County. Thank you so much.
Thank you.